koutou, haere mai ki Kickarts, Auckland's comprehensive art show, brought to you every Sunday night here at 104.6 Planet FM or live stream planetaudio.org.nz. Call Richard Green, 10A, your host for the next 90 minutes. And in the studio this week, I haven't got Georgia with me. Georgia and I actually did some work together outside of the studio yesterday. There was a fantastic event in Papakura. It was the Papakura Street Fest with entertainment and arts and stalls and crafts and music and fun. We closed Great South Road for 4 hours and set up some tents and had a great time. It was fantastic. But Georgia's a little under the weather. She's worked more than 2 days in a row, which is quite surprising in the arts. So, so she's probably having a bit of a wee rest at home. Actually, there's a bit of a nasty bug going around. I've got a few people who've dropped down and out because of it. So be careful out there. Lots of vitamin C. Keep warm. Keep happy. Keep smiling and keep listening for the next 90 minutes. And I'm just going to introduce our guests in the studio. Dope. It's a controversial subject, isn't it? Should we legalise it? Should we decriminalise it? Or is it even relevant to the play that's opening next week at Te Pō? It's part of the Rangatahi season, a continuation. It's been going for about 12 weeks, I think, the Rangatahi season. And I've got Maya in the studio with me from Dope.
Hi.
Kia ora and welcome.
G'day.
So what's your role with Dope?
I'm the producer.
Right.
Yep, and just any odd jobs that need doing, basically.
Which is the role of a producer, really, isn't
100%.
It? 100%. In Aotearoa, New Zealand, when you're working in the theatre. And you open on Wednesday.
We do indeed.
Okay.
For sure.
I'm interested to hear what this is about, because making assumptions from the title.
No, you're rightly assuming. It's a conversation about dope, especially in New Zealand, and it centres on a young family, particularly on a person that is just called the older sister. And she is confronted perhaps for the first time that she might have an addiction, while her younger brother starts to experiment with weed for the first time as well, and he is an incredibly nervous person and finds the whole thing just a little bit too much. And then additionally, we look at the mum and the dad who essentially try and figure out how you talk to your kids about that and whether or not it's worth letting them figure things out or if you need to intervene.
Chances are they've probably tried it themselves.
Anyway. Absolutely.
Those parents, eh? They're not above reproach, really, as much as I like to think we are. Well, welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
And starting soon, too, is the International Documentary Film Festival, which is running again in Q Theatre.
Q
Theatre. And I've got John, who's a producer of a film called Let's Talk About Sex, and also a Planet FM film reviewer with Joe as well here at Planet FM Studios. And does this make my arts look big? Joe was our host for that. And also we've got Luke. Luke is the subject of the film To Be or Not To Be and also a musician. That's right, isn't it, Luke? I got that. I nailed that.
I think that's the name of the film, To Be or Not To Be.
Have you seen it yet?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Oh, it's a delightful experience working with the people who did the movie.
Yeah.
Crystal Chen directed it. She did a great job.
Yeah, it's a really nice piece. Really, really looking forward to it. And, John, your film, you produced the film Let's Talk About Sex, that's correct, isn't it?
Co-produced with my director, Lisa.
Okay.
Lisa Bird.
Yeah. Co-producing, so that means you only do half the work that Maya does as a producer.
No.
She's got someone else.
No, I relate to Maya because, I mean, basically producer equals crap manager.
Yeah. Every job ever.
Yeah. And the way it worked really was Lisa was out in the field. She did all the field production and she and I would talk about all the big decisions and we'd work all that out. But my job was to do logistics behind the scenes, finances, all that kind of thing.
Wow. The important stuff. Finances.
Probably the least important in terms of actual result on screen, but anyway.
Absolutely.
But if you run out of money, you can't finish the project, eh? So someone's got to manage it.
Very true.
Someone's got to manage it. And speaking of managing, for the last 7 years, Anne has been the artistic director of the Writers' Festival here in Auckland. That's the full name of it, isn't it? The Auckland Writers' Festival.
Auckland Writers' Festival,
yep. And welcome to the studio. Seven years. Wow, that's a long tenure.
It is. It's been an interesting ride. I mean, I started as the artistic director, and in those days we had that dual model that you get in some arts organisations with a general manager and an artistic director, and then things changed around and I took over the whole thing. So, this will be my seventh programme. We start on the 15th of May, and we've gone from about a 90-event programme in that time with attendance about 24,000 to a 207-event programme this year, I think.
Oh, my God.
With attendance of 73,000. So, yeah, it's a pretty huge beast these days.
So are you, would you be a significant Auckland event? So are you supported by AT at all?
We are supported by AT. Right, that's where we come in. And we get, you know, of that visitorship, 20% of it's coming from outside of Auckland, and about 4% of that 20% is coming from outside New Zealand, mainly Australia.
Specifically for the Writers' Festival?
Specifically for the Writers' Festival. It was kind of kick-started a little bit by Murakami, who we had about 3 years ago in an exclusive, and that sort of caught the attention of people offshore. But now, yeah, we do get a bunch of people who come across because it's a very kind of intensive but highly energetic and vibrant kind of 4 or 5 days. And actually, we also have people in Auckland who leave home and book into a hotel in town and just make that their weekend away from home.
Gosh.
And did you get the Proust of the modern age to turn up for this one?
Mr. Knausgaard, I did.
Is that how you pronounce his name?
Well, it's how I pronounce it, although someone told me the other day I might have that slightly wrong. But, yeah, I met him actually at a party in at the New Yorker Festival a few years ago, and I ended up at this party. It's one of the most extraordinary moments of my life. So it was on the top floor of the Standard Hotel on the High Line. There were women in togas, there was an open bar, and there was Sting in the corner, and I just thought, I don't know what I'm doing here, we should go home. So I said to my partner, we'll have one drink and then we'll leave. And then we had two drinks.
You didn't want to go up and talk to Sting?
Well, at that point I thought it was pretty tacky to walk up to people and say, hi, I'm Anne from Auckland, would you like to come to my festival?
Yeah.
But after the third glass of champagne, I thought, what the hell? I didn't talk to Sting, but I did talk to Carl Over and Zadie Smith and Ari Kunzru.
How did you meet Carl Over? Because I didn't think he was very social. Like, was he in a corner of the room?
Yeah, he was in one corner of the room with Zadie Smith and a couple of other sort of pretty major writers, and they were just standing around. So I did, in fact, just go up to him and say, I'm Anne, and here's my card. And then, of course, what happened after that is I got referred to his agent, who is an agent, so it can be a very complicated process.
It took three years.
And every year I would email Charles and say, so Charles, you know, is this the year? And he'd say, Carl Over is very busy and he is working on something. But, he said, but he remembers meeting you and he remembers saying he would come, and he is a man of his word. Wow. So this last year in about September, when I emailed Charles thinking, yep, we'll just tick that off, Charles said, this is your year.
Is he sold out yet?
He's not sold out. He's in the
ticket.
He's in the big auditorium, so that seats 2,000. So there's still some tickets there.
Got any freebies?
Let's see how the next 90 minutes go.
Ooh, there's a bit of a challenge. Hey, now, just excuse my ignorance about this author you're talking about, but could you put a context around that? Who this author is, obviously somebody that I should know about, should I?
Yeah, he's kind of the rock star of the literary world. So Carl Ove Knausgaard is a Norwegian. He's about 6'4", quite rugged, smokes like a chimney, wears a leather jacket. And what he did, I mean, he's written a number of books, including on football and the artist Edvard Munch. But what he did was he set out to write sort of what people are calling autobiographical fiction. So he took the details of his life, both mundane and profound, and he's written a 6-part series called My Struggle, where he has unpicked the minutiae of his life in a way of kind of observing who we are in the world. In the process of doing so, he's offended most members of his family. The first in the series is called A Death in the Family, and it's around the death of his father. And a lot of people are very offended about the detail to which he has told that story. But he has become a phenomenon around the world. In fact, I watched him being interviewed by Christiane Amanpour last week on CNN. And I met someone recently who said to me, oh, God, I was in Berlin. And they had a 6-hour symposium on him while he was there. So in the first hour, they talked about him while he sat there, and then they all read some of his work, and then they acted out scenes from his work in the foyer. So, yeah, he's a bit of a rock star god in the world. And it is definitely the work is a matter of taste. So some people love it, and some people just can't be doing with it.
So, but, Luke, you're a fan then?
Well, yeah, The Death in the Family, was that the one with the grandmother and the father in the house? And the father is given alcohol by the grandmother, and he's just sort of prone there, and he's just sort of like slowly dying while he's being
That's right.
Fed and
yeah,
that's it. And
yeah. And now he's done a 4-part series named on the seasons, inspired by the birth of his children. So
it's amazing.
Yeah,
I read about two or three of them.
Yeah.
Wow. And kind of book you lend it, and if you lend one of his books, you'll never get it back.
Okay. Anne, could you lend me a couple of books?
Sure. And we'll have some more at the festival.
And now, John, speaking of offending, John.
Oh, come on.
Well, let's talk about sex.
Sex, man.
I know.
Sex, baby.
As I said to you in the green room, I didn't have the chance to watch the whole thing, but I skim-watched just when it came to a different part. I just saw the variation. So this film's a discussion in New Zealand about sex that you've produced. And
correct.
Ranging from the interviewer's parents to a dominatrix, madam, a sex worker, a gigolo.
Multiple sex workers.
A gigolo. I was included in the sex workers.
Sorry, well, that's where I was going.
And so people on the street.
People on the street and people of knowledge.
Yeah. You managed to
skip over all the people with knowledge.
Yeah,
And go straight to the sensational.
Well, there's the sex therapist and the... I couldn't work out the woman in Mount Maunganui.
Somatic sex coach.
Yes, that was the term, somatic.
And my link there was going to be, well, if I was in the same room as Sting, I'd be grabbing him to be in my film to talk to Ellie about tantric sex.
Wow. Right. Oh, she's about tantric sex, is that?
That's one of her many aspects,
yeah. I got the sense with the dreadlocks and the tattoos and the bag that she was coming from a spiritual point of view.
Are you stereotyping someone?
I absolutely am,
okay,
yes.
And why not? It's a good starting place as any.
Yeah, I thought she seemed to fit the mould, so I went with that.
Well, Ellie's last name is Wild, and I think basically she lives up to her her name, yeah,
so,
absolutely.
So where did you came on board as producer when?
The director, Lisa Bird, had worked on Real Housewives of Auckland and had worked with Julia Sloan, who's our host. And Julia had this incident on the Real Housewives of Auckland where she dragged her drawer of sex toys out for all the other housewives and got an interesting reaction. And from that, she was looking to explore what our reactions are as New Zealanders to discussions around sexuality and sex. And so we grew a story from that. But Lisa and Julia came to me and said, come on board and help with some of the work. And that's how I got involved.
Wow. It's an interesting topic, isn't it? Because we don't discuss it very often.
The film is all about... And it's amazing how people were open to talking to us. Like, you identified some of the people on the street.
Mm.
You know, we had a young German girl.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I saw her, yeah.
And she talks about having lost her virginity, having arrived here in Auckland, and the pressure she felt to have sex for the first time. But then after she'd had it, she rang her parents.
Ooh.
And she had a long discussion in some detail about the things that happened in her first sexual encounter. Come and see the film for the whole story.
Do you think that a New Zealander would have had that same conversation with their parents? Was there a cultural kind of difference there?
I think the parental thing was a surprise to all of us when that came up. I don't think anyone expected that. But we didn't just... She was German. It was just an accident. You know, we were just walking up to people in the viaduct and saying, hey, want to talk about sex?
Did you play the song?
No, but the German girl sings it at the end of her interview. And that was fantastic because we use that in the trailer and it really does say the thing and we don't have to pay performance rights for it. But that's one thing I should say. Everyone who appears in the film, no money. They just did it to help.
Yeah.
But the New Zealanders probably wouldn't openly have that kind of discussion. We're not quite in that paradigm. The European paradigm is different. But the fact is we talk to a whole bunch of people down at the viaduct and they're all happy to talk to us. Mm. There's a wonderful scene where a couple of skaters who are partners.
I watched that one too.
They just start talking.
Hilarious.
And he's very funny.
He's funny.
He's a natural
great
comic.
Talent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you get to watch the whole scene with the two of them playing off with each other, it's brilliant.
They're obviously having a fun time together. That came across really quite strongly.
They seem to be into each other in a good,
lot.
Hot and heavy way.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah,
a lot.
A lot.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
But yeah. it was just great fun. It was nice to find people would talk about it. Mm. And then of course there's all our interview subjects. Some of them are in the sex industry. They're not going to not talk about it. But the openness of all the individuals on the whole. Mm. I mean, we had a couple of failed interviews, obviously, but it was great.
And Luke, the film To Be or Not to Be is about you just talking about being a musician, busker, and your life.
I think it started out where we're talking about the influence of my father. Mm. Because my father was a doctor and a writer and a painter, and he wrote a manuscript in the 60s, and we've been trying to get it finished. He couldn't finish it himself, actually, and there's a particular lengthy section about Zanzibar, the Zanzibar Revolution in 1964, which happened, I think it started 11th of January 1964, a minority party got in, and it was only in power for a very short time, and then there was an overthrow, and he wrote about this. There's a long section in his book, and his book's called 25 Milligrams of Hallelujah.
Nice title.
Yeah, and he talks about his time in Africa. He was a doctor to Kamathi in the Mau Mau Rebellion. Mm-hmm. He talks about that. There's a chapter about that. And we're just trying to get this finished since he passed away in 1976. He was trying himself to get it finished. And that was very much on my mind. And when I met Crystal and the crew, she asked me, what is the theme that you would like to think of for this movie? And it's kind of like Voids Around My Father, like the Mortimer's thing. Mm-hmm. I thought something in the kind of the thing is, the four sons, I'm the youngest, we're all in the shadow of this great man. I mean, it was incredible. So Renaissance man, like kind of the surgery, the writing,
painting.
Mm-hmm. Played as well. We played classical guitar. And extraordinary talent. I mean, it was the four of us were just completely in right. the shadow. None of
How
us have come anywhere
he...
near that kind of.
How old were you when he died?
I was about 19.
Okay.
Yeah, and the revolution in Zanzibar was in 1964, so I was about 7 years old when that happened. So, going through this manuscript, I kind of remember things, you know, coming back. So anyway, that was very much on my mind at the time. So I wanted the documentary to be focusing on that in relation to my father, which is something that's always been in my mind, and the things that he talked about, you know, the things he directed me towards in terms of developing the art. So I think that's really what the theme of the movie was. Mm. So we talked to people in the busking and all that kind of stuff. And also the connection in the street and how it's extraordinary the people you meet when you're just playing in the street and the things that you discover about life.
Do people stop and talk to you as you're playing? Is that a common
that's
part
that's really
of
the main That's yeah? really the main reason I'm there. I mean, I'm playing. I love to share my music, obviously, but the people. You see, I really think interpersonal contact is something that's kind of missing, and it's kind of being overshadowed by Netflix and phones and computers. And it's got to a stage where we kind of, as in Postman's book, we talked about amusing ourselves to death, and it's kind of like we're in amusing ourselves too much, and we've got these amazing tools now. And if we use them as tools, we can do great things. But I think it's so much of a temptation to just get slip into the shoulder of the road and watch Netflix instead of using this amazing machine, this iPhone or whatever, as a tool, you know. And everybody's kind of lost in that cyber world, and they're kind of dubbing. And I think the last bastion of interpersonal connection is the street. So that's really where I'm coming from, that interpersonal connection, and how I was kind of rebellion against some of the things that my father was doing, because he was just super intellectual and he, you know, he'd got FRCS and a whole life of intense study and everything. And I think he actually encouraged me to rebel, because really he said secretly, and well, he wasn't that secret about it, he says that if he had a choice he would have been a painter rather than a surgeon.
Wow.
He had pressure from his family to do that. But he loved it, you know, he did love it. But it's kind of hard to fathom someone like that, you know. It's like this Leonardo type character that I never saw because he's working so hard. Because, you know, working big long hours and then you come home and he has to go and lock himself away in the studio. We never really saw him.
Yeah.
He's like a mystic person.
Do you see in yourself bits that you think, ah, oh, that's my dad and me? You know, sometimes do you catch yourself doing something and think, that's my dad?
Well, I got a huge compliment from one of my brothers where he thought that I kind of almost got to, almost surpassed him in the area of art in terms of developing my art and getting it to people. So I felt really honoured by that. But to be honest, and we were talking about our Norwegian friend, the unpronounceable.
Yeah, that man.
It's amazing because I've had a struggle. Like, what I love about that guy, it's amazing that you're here, by the way, because he's really set me free in the last couple of years, because I just typed into Google one day in complete desperation and said, I've got this side of me where, I've struggled with self-loathing, where I really hate myself, and I grew up sort of feeling that I was kind of right on. I don't know where it came from, but the amazing thing is he articulates that very well, that self-loathing. That's how I found him, because one day I thought, well, let's deal with this, all this kind of self-criticism, really pulling myself down. I mean, I don't think that's unique. I mean, billions of people have had that.
Yeah.
But in my case, it's so intense.
It's part of the New Zealand culture, in a sense, isn't it? Yeah. It's almost, you feel...
It's global.
Yeah.
There was a discussion on another radio station earlier today where they were...
There's other radio stations?
Sadly for you, one or two. Or 200. But there was a discussion going on between a leadership coach and the host about this very concept, and that basically half of us worldwide fall into periods of being unhappy with ourselves. Yeah. I'm not going to go quite as far as self-loathing.
Yeah, I bet I'm a lot unhappier with myself than you are. So I think I've won here.
Well, I was going to come back, though.
A competition.
Your father and yourself and how you are now talking about how the ability to interact with people in the streets is where it's at. It gives you the much more fulfilling dialogue with people than you can possibly get off a Facebook conversation or whatever. And that's really interesting, because in an environment where it sounds like your father basically said, hi, son, bye, son, is that roughly right?
Well, it wasn't so. No, it actually wasn't so, because what happened is we ended up in Gore. And in Gore, in Southland at that time, there was a very it was very difficult to find surgeons. So he was a surgeon superintendent of Gore Hospital. He was working night and day, so he was like working a full day, coming home, and he was on call because they couldn't find another. They really needed another surgeon, so he was doing the work of two people, and he was on call, he was working 24/7. And when he did have a break, well, he'd like to paint or you know, maybe hit the old hit the lager or whatever, you know. Because but the thing is. Yeah, he had it too, this kind of self-deprecating thing, and wow. he had that pretty strongly. But the thing I really want to stress is I started out wanting to write songs, record songs, get a publisher or whatever, and I just don't want to meet anybody. I'd be quite happy to lock myself away in a room forever. That's how I felt. But what I discovered was, as soon as I recorded something, this really crazily impossible thing of promoting it, as you may all be aware of this, how incredibly... I mean, it's all very well having the product. You're at the foothills, and the Everest is to try and reach people.
Well, and that's across the different genres of arts, isn't it? Whether it's film or music or theatre or books.
And that got me out of my room.
Yeah, you've got to find a way to actually find your audience.
And there's a Chinese saying, they say, you can't go to your room, shut the door, and build a car.
That's a Chinese saying.
unless, of course, you live in some mechanic's house. I'm going to throw this to you, Maya, because we're talking about communication and how it's, you know, it's changed, and the thing around Facebook and being lack of interpersonal relationships. Are you part of the millennial generation?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's very much a part of...
It's part of our world.
Part of your world. So how do you... What do you have any comment on that from...
I mean, with the play specifically... All of our promotion has been exclusively Facebook. And I think that comes down a little bit to who our audience is. Like, the play isn't necessarily for everyone. It's it's a conversation very much aimed at under 30, essentially, and it's this thing
we can all
of,
go home then.
which isn't to say that it doesn't have like relevance for anyone else. It definitely does, especially in the parent characters. They're like quite touching, and they're definitely autobiographical as well. They're very much based on like Dan's real life, and I think for us, we were just like, the best way to get to our audience is going to be through Facebook, and we ended up doing a call out just through our like our company page for like experiences with weed, whether that was good or bad or first times or I'm a regular user or I'm a recovering addict or whatever. And the response was so overwhelming, like incredibly overwhelming. And we got everything from, you know, people running around thinking that they're Mario Kart and they're just like absolutely like high as balls. And then we get other people coming down and being like, my parents both smoked weed and it affected me so much growing up and I didn't feel like I could ever really call them out on it, and so it's never been something that I wanted to try. And it's, yeah, it's just been this really interesting sort of form of interaction, especially with theatre, because obviously, like, it's hard enough to get an audience there, isn't it? Let alone, you know, just using Facebook as your main avenue, but...
It's quite common, though, isn't it? I see a lot of
especially with development theatre. I mean, it's the cheapest medium by a long shot.
It's free.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, what's interesting about it, though, sometimes don't you feel like you're just talking to yourselves all the time?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you can find your tribe, if you like, there. But if you want to break beyond that, that's a much harder thing.
And you've got this kind of Savonarola figure standing over you, and he's going to kind of... What was that, Baudelaire? Or who's the guy who put fig leaves on Michelangelo's paintings on Sistine Chapel? You know, like, it's kind of like Facebook's doing that now, aren't they? They're playing the role of, like, Savonarola in the Renaissance, and you've got Baudelaire, who actually censor Shakespeare. Baudelaireizing, the Savonarola. You've got that kind of...
That's the conversation around in Facebook, isn't it? Where they're cutting out photos and certain things you can't post and words, they'll cut things that have offensive words.
I always feel like there's someone looking over my shoulder if I'm going.
Well, there was a lovely meme going around just recently that said, do you know, I always feel like they're watching me all the time and they're spelt T-H-E-I-R. And then it comes in and it says... CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, in bracket CIA, their account says their, THY'RE. So it's like, they are just, you know, playing on that.
Well, I mean, it's a social medium. It's outward facing. Yeah. You can't play on that medium. I mean, obviously, you can see your privacy settings, but in the end, you're there because you're actually looking for an audience.
Yeah.
Sorry. I found it interesting that we couldn't get all of our clips that we took from the film up on Facebook. Facebook took them back down.
Oh, really?
Really? Mm.
Yeah. There's Savonarola right there.
Is that because of the content of the...
Because the content of what was in there.
But there's no nudity in there or anything. There's
no
sex.
But there was a fuck machine.
Well, there's a...
I'm not allowed to say that, am I?
Well, no, it's in context.
We haven't quite hit the time.
Can you just tell... I'm just
2 minutes away.
What is that? So, for those of us who...
It's a pneumatic machine with a dildo-style object or possibly a... object with a hole in it that thrusts forward and back,
right?
Which I can't do on the radio, but everyone
else...
Well,
you are doing it anyway.
Everyone else gets the idea, but you dear listeners don't. But think about it. And Facebook wouldn't take that.
Yeah.
Although, maybe I'm a bit conservative or whatever the word is for it, but I suppose that's fair enough. I don't know if that's something that... Maybe they do have, you know, maybe there are some... Do you reckon there's parameters, or do you think it would be better if there was absolutely no censorship? I mean, they're in a very difficult position, aren't they? I mean, imagine how would they actually censor stuff? What is their criterion there?
I don't know. This is a whole other radio show, really, isn't it? But just from what they do censor, it seems to be a bit picky and choosy because they let people get away under free speech.
Quite arbitrary.
Yeah,
It's kind of like... It's like
racist, bigoted comments can
pass. On the one hand, a woman breastfeeding unregulated.
It can now. I just read today that basically Facebook's obviously modified in the last 6 months or so, and now you can see a woman's mastectomy. Yeah. Thank you. You can see breastfeeding. then there was a third thing that they used to ban that they now don't ban. No. So they are being a little bit responsive. But to be fair, they have set their standards somewhere in the Midwest Bible Belt of America. And the world isn't sitting there.
No.
The world is sitting in other places. I mean, you go to Europe, Facebook Europe, if there was such a thing, wouldn't have those kinds of restrictions.
Mm.
But to go back to the discussion on censorship, you do need to find ways to have a level of control over people who want to show things that are strictly not legal.
Mm.
Okay? So that needs to be dealt to.
Mm.
But in the wider sense, I would rather people had the freedom to
express
what they want to do, if it's consensual and if it's not in outside of the boundaries of what is law.
I see a lot of people on Facebook justify their comments because of free speech, particularly racist and sexist comments, which I find kind of annoying. But that whole free speech argument only goes so far, as far as. And just pick up. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, well, I mean, all of those arguments only go so far. Everyone wants freedom, but actually, you know, you stop at a red light. You do all sorts. Every single day we do things that have parameters
around them. Not many people in Auckland stop at red lights.
No, they certainly don't indicate. So I'm a Wellingtonian at heart, I can say that. Our whole lives are kind of, you know, there is some modicum of control, because otherwise it would be absolute anarchy. It just doesn't work. So.
And 200-odd events must be anarchy.
Well, we're very
really.
Controlled in our organisation.
Yeah. Like how do you keep track of all those events? I mean, how long does it take you? Is it a year, 2 years to plan?
It's a year cycle because we deliver annually. So some, particularly the international sort of list, some of that rolls over. So you ask someone and they say not this year, but next year and next year and next year, and they turn up. But, yeah, basically it's a 12-month cycle. As I like to say, from June to December we have to raise the money. So we're a $2 million operation. We have to raise about 1.3 of it. The rest comes from box office. And then we spend it. So I organise it with a spreadsheet in my head. So, I know in terms of budget and footprint, I'm looking for about 40 internationals. I'm looking for about 160 New Zealanders. I'm looking for a range of work. I want the program to engage broadly and deeply. So I'm looking for the most diverse group. So I want something that appeals to under 30s, but I also need to look after my core patronage, who, quite frankly, you know, are our bread and butter. They buy tickets, they come every year, they buy lots of tickets. So I need to make sure that, you know, AC Grayling, for example, the philosopher, I mean, we've sold about 1,400 tickets to his main session now, and that's our core audience stuff. So I'm looking to be as diverse as I can within what's available to me at any time.
140 local.
Well, there's 230 participants in total.
Yeah.
There's about 42 internationals this year. The rest of them, there's a bunch of people who are just purely interviewers, you know, so Noel McCarthy or... But
they're not all writers, though.
No, well, I do, because interviewing is a particular skill. They're the most critical person on a stage at a writer's festival. So if you get the chair wrong, it's a disaster for everyone. So there is a bunch of, particularly journalists, that we use.
Yeah.
To do that interviewing, but primarily everyone's on stage as a writer. So the rest of that participants are all New Zealanders, yeah.
$2 million, goodness.
I got a screenwriting credit for my film.
Okay.
Next year.
Yeah. We should talk.
Oh.
Yeah. There's people pitch me every day in every way. We have people bringing us up from...
I'm an internationally award-winning screenwriter.
Okay. We might have a panel discussion.
I'm in the Guinness Book of Records.
For?
So, writing, being a screenwriter on a film that had the most screenwriters ever. So a project called 50 Kisses.
Okay.
About 6 years ago, they asked for a two-minute script based around the idea of a kiss, and that was the only criteria. It had to contain a kiss. So I wrote a screenplay and put it in and got accepted and got nominated for Best Screenplay, and 50 of them were eventually chosen from 1,400, and they made the film.
Wow.
By people then choosing the film that they wanted to write.
Yep.
A film, and then filming it and sending that in as another part of the competition, and then they edited them all together. 52-minute short films with the same theme. It was an amazing project.
Wow.
Well, could I ask, do you get, from the festival, do you get many signings? People being at the festival and talking to the right people there and bringing their manuscripts? Is there a sharing process going on between writers and agents and publishers, or is that kind of not really encouraged?
No, that's kind of business out the side. I mean, obviously everyone's in the halls and there is a series of, I mean, we run a workshop program. So this festival was set up by two New Zealand writers, Peter Wells and Stephanie Johnson, and its driver was to engage New Zealand readers with New Zealand work. So that's the core, one of the core kind of principles of the festival. And so everything else is kind of built around that. So supporting writers' work, providing with opportunities to think about their craft, to meet their peers, to do all those sort of things, is all part of the sort of bigger fabric. But obviously the immediate delivery is about getting readers into the halls and engaging them with the work, with the best work we can find from around the world.
Yeah. And Maya, are you wanting to, with this, engage your audience around this conversation, around this topic?
100%.
And get them talking about it? Was that the motivation for the project?
Yeah, so when Dan wrote it, he very much wanted it to be a conversation about Weed, not pushing an agenda either way. There's so many different opinions that are put forward in the play, and you know, they range entirely from it should be entirely legalized to no one should ever touch it ever in a million years, and the whole point is to start people talking about it. And like, for example, after the play, we've got a bunch of resources from the Drug Foundation, we've got Mental Health Foundation, we've got a group called Pot Help who run through the Drug Foundation as well, and it's designed to have all these resources available for people so that when they do leave the show and, you know, you sit there and you're like, I really like that last bit with the lights and stuff. And then they, you know, they finally start getting to the crux of things and they do start talking about like the place of weed in New Zealand, and especially with legislation going through this weekend, just on J-Day, they're starting to talk about how we're going to deal with medical marijuana in this country because it is becoming such a like a worldwide issue. And we're starting to fall behind in terms of, especially with California and that side of the States. And so yeah, our whole idea with the play really is to just like spark the conversation, especially with young people. There's so many young people who they know what they believe, but they're absolutely not informed, and there's such an apathy, especially towards politics, that we really just want to start those conversations just so that they start to grow and people start to think about what they do think and how important that will then be in terms of legislation going forward.
There's nothing better than putting up an opposing point of view to get someone to think about what they think.
100%.
You know, why do I think that? Does that really stack up? What is someone else saying to me? I mean, I think, you know, it's... I mean, one of the things about a writers' festival is it's much easier to get left-wing voices on the stage. For some reason, right-wing voices care about money and left-wing voices care about discourse. Go figure. Yeah. But, you know, I actually want to put different voices on the stage. You know, we often get, you know, why haven't you invited Neil Ferguson? Well, you know what? I've been inviting him for 15 years to various festivals. Because actually, if we just listen to the people, goes back to the thing, if we just listen to the people who think and say the same things that we do, we never
silo.
Get anywhere. Silo. And it's, I think it's the most dangerous thing at the moment, because actually people are refusing to listen to anybody 100%. Who doesn't sort of share their worldview.
And that totally comes back to the social media thing where you're like, you're overwhelmed. Like, I'll be the first to admit that, like, I was listening to a sermon this morning that was talking about how we're just absolutely overwhelmed. Like, you can roll over in the morning and you just pick up your phone and there it all is. Like, you just are so overwhelmed, so you do have to hear what you don't want to hear in order to figure out what you think in the first place. And I think that's truer than ever for my generation.
I figured through that, though. I now get the spin-off bulletin sent to my email
yes!
every
Me too.
Morning.
It's so great.
And it filters
so
the media
brilliant.
Through, so all the good articles that come through, I don't have to read through Granny Herald page
yes.
by page anymore. It's nice.
What's
the spin-off?
They
do an email bulletin out, so they basically pick the best stories of the day and list them out and give you links to them, and it's all analysed. I mean, I'm just a bit biased because I like some of the writing in there, but the thing about the spin-off, you talk about living in a silo, they have right-wing and left-wing writers and they're contributing to it, and so you do get that view, and that's important. The arts tend to be more left and liberal by way of nature. Why is that? Why do you think the arts are left and liberal and not conservative? That's a very, very general comment,
isn't it? It's a really good question.
It's true. That's where the funding comes from. There's a lot of funding for that, isn't it?
For
that area, like political avenue, there's a lot of funding for it.
I'm not sure of donations from in the arts. Why is the art? Why do you think the arts is left? Do you think the arts is more left wing than?
Well, I just think art's art. I don't think it's
anything?
One of the big problems I see is it's become politicised. I don't think it needs to be. No? And again, it's coming back to that theme of the Middle Ages, you know, where Botticelli had to burn a whole lot of his nudity because he was supposed to supposedly become a Christian. So he's got to burn a whole lot of anything with references to Roman and Greek gods or anything like that, you know. And it's coming again.
But
exactly.
They have, I read, I think, about 3 weeks ago that they are, in the United States, they are banning images in some museums of paintings of nubile women from, you know, Renaissance and those eras because it's not decent.
We're back to censorship.
Well, this is
who's driving that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it seems to be from the state level as opposed to... But, I mean, Trump has given permission for this sort of thing to happen. Mm. That's just a personal opinion. But
I agree.
It's that thing about censorship. It's really interesting because I have my grandparents immigrated from England. And on their way over here on a boat, they picked up this artifact, which is an African man cocktail set. And it's a classic piece of historical, you know, design.
Kitsch
design.
Yeah.
And when he passed away, I grabbed a couple of things, and that was one of them, and his cardigans, and his Māori carvings he made. But I had someone come in, and they were highly offended by it. And they said, I should put it away or get rid of it. And I said, well, it sits there because it's tong of my family, but also it represents art of a particular time. Mm. And I know what the connotations of it are. You know, and I know it's, you'd never buy it now at the warehouse and put it proudly on your mantelpiece as a display unit. But it sort of has some historical context. And how does censorship, do we censor the past in art? Do we start censoring music? Do we start censoring books? And I said to him, they said, you've got to, things of that are offensive now may not have been offensive before, we should get rid of them. And I said, so that's what happened when Adolf Hitler started burning books because they were offensive to that culture. Mm. Is that, you know, is it? It's a hard,
it is really complicated
conversation.
I think at the moment, I am very conflicted about it, but you sort of have to listen to the people to whom those are their stories. I think that's the thing. Yep. So actually, yes, that belongs in a time and place and it's a tongue of your family, but actually if it's representative of a relationship between an imperial culture and an African culture or whatever, and actually that culture is saying, actually, we just need a moment to be able to, you know, move past that, then I guess we have to listen because actually we are, in that sense, you know, in the position of power here. We've inherited that. Yeah. And so we have
white privilege.
Yeah, white privilege, that's right.
Yeah. And I get that. It's just good to have the conversation about it, though, isn't it? And that's what we don't... This is going back to yours and the theme of what you're talking about. It's about having those conversations about very tricky subjects.
Well, and that's what a Writers' Festival is, actually. And what's really interesting about the growth in Writers' Festivals is there's such hunger to have that discourse, actually. Yeah. People do want to get in a room and talk about these things because I think the places where we've done that are kind of contracting, you know, if you think about current affairs, if you think about those avenues, community kind of connection, which you were talking about, that's all kind of disappearing. Mm. And so you need those places.
Interpersonal connection. It's getting rarer and rarer.
So are your songs, do they have a theme, a particular theme?
Oh, that one definitely. I've got one called Mechanical. It's about you're not a machine. And we actually kind of controlled by the things we made. That's the general thing. With the way it seems to be going now is that we're getting superseded by our own creation, which is really weird. Because with the advance of AI, it's getting to the point now where it's kind of able to run itself. Did you hear about? I haven't confirmed it. Maybe you've heard about this in Japan. They made some AI soldiers that actually killed a number of people.
I haven't heard that.
Have you heard about that?
No.
They ran amok and a few people got killed, I understand.
AI is always going to be challenging.
These are actual soldier robots that weren't programmed right and they killed a few people.
God. That song, The Mechanicals, would you play it for us?
Yeah, sure.
It's an original composition?
Yeah, it's something I've been working on for many years, and so I play it now, yeah?
Yeah, that'd be great, thank you.
Oh, yeah? Oh, yeah? anyway, I don't know. This is possibly, you know, hearsay, but yeah, I heard that these soldiers, these robot soldiers, went mental. We sort of don't. We don't really need that, do we? We don't need robot soldiers, do we?
Soldiers by nature are robots, really, aren't they?
It's a little bit misguided, isn't it?
Yeah.
We make our own mistakes too, so, yeah. I mean, you know, who's better, who's worse, I'm not sure. Yeah.
I'll do a shorter version because it can go on for ages, this song. I'll give you a Reader's Digest compressed version. You are not a machine.
For me, that kind of, it's Pink Floydish.
Ah, Pink Floyd.
Yeah, yes, that yes. would be a kind of a Gilmour kind of song. It's David Gilmour.
Yeah. I was thinking about, you know, influences, and I think one thing I forgot.
I'll just get you to turn your mic back up too.
This guy, what's his name? Hitchcock. Robin Hitchcock. Have you heard him?
No.
Or have you heard the Smiths? Of course, you know the Smiths.
Yep.
And Jethro Tull and all that stuff. Yeah. Yeah, Pink Floyd, interesting. Yeah, you know, with Syd Barrett, he was a genius, wasn't he, with that Siemily play and all that.
Yeah.
And the cow on the front and the cover. You know which one's that? Well, Atomic something or Atom or something.
I know this, the cow on the front, Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
I'll have to, if my co-host was here, Luke, she would have Googled it by now, and she's a millennial, and she's just, oh, straight away, that's, there it is there.
It's like 278. I was recording in the country, and there's this cow, and they call her 278. Because that's a herd number. Oh. It's the most beautiful cow you ever saw, and it's like the Pink Floyd cow. And I'd really love to have 278 on the cover of my country album because I recorded it in the country.
So, have you produced albums?
I have indeed. Yeah, if you just look up my website, lukehurley.co.nz, it's all there.
But mostly, your goal is to connect through being on the street. Is that right?
Well, like I said, my goal at the beginning was I hated myself. And I was kind of shy of interacting with anybody, and I just wanted to actually seal myself in a... if I could have, I would have put myself in an atomic bunker, write songs, record songs, try and get them published, and never meet anybody, and live off the royalties. That was kind of my dream. But unfortunately, I couldn't do that, which is very fortunate. Yeah. Unfortunately, I couldn't do that, because, as I say, I had to actually find a way to get people to listen to... Mm. And man, that is insane. The actual art of creating it, recording it, having it ready to listen to is the foothills, and Everest is the promotion.
And for New Zealand writers, we had a, just trying to remember her name earlier, a publisher on the show at the beginning of the year, and she said they had a struggle with international publishers publishing New Zealand work, and that New Zealand doesn't seem to be up there as far as, you know, they're trying to educate international publishers that New Zealand writers are actually quite good really. I mean, my favourite book at the moment is Life After Life.
Right.
And it's just, you know, I just like... Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that New Zealand's alone in that. I don't know if you're interested to talk about the film.
No, The Wish Child, sorry, not Life.
The Wish Child, Catherine Chidi. Yeah.
That's Catherine Atkinson, but I was reading that. I meant The Wish Child. Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, I mean, publishing has been dominated by, well, in New Zealand, by England, by the UK, because Commonwealth publishing rights have come down that way. And obviously the US, they're these monolithic, you know, big business countries. And so it is very difficult for all sorts of countries to break in to that market. I'm not sure. I mean, there's a handful of people in Australia, you know, who are internationally published, Peter Carey, Tim Winton, Helen Garner. It's not a lot, not more than that. So, yeah, I think it's difficult. I think it's difficult to be small at the end of the world and find your place in the international scene. But I mean, even more interesting is how it can be quite difficult to get New Zealanders to recognise that New Zealand work is as good as international.
That's right. I think that's the same with our music. I mean, it took a while for our music to be recognised as being...
It's more just a small group, isn't it? I mean, it's nothing... It's just the way it works. Like... In Jordan Peterson's book, you know, 12 Rules, he talks about how in the classical world, all the classical recordings that we listen to, it just comes down to a very small number of names. There's maybe like Bach, Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, one or two others. It's maybe about seven names, and that's most of the material. So it's the same in everything, in the movies, and books, and everything, you know. And New Zealand music business, probably you could... Count them on fingers of two hands, probably.
There's some hope for theatre, though, isn't there? There's a lot of development work being done by younger people at the moment. That sounds too... By younger people.
Just sit back.
And do nothing, eh? We just sit back and just drink tea.
We're Generation Zero and we're officially hated by... Generation Zero officially hates us.
What generation are you?
I'm a baby boomer.
Me too. Just at the cusp of the baby boomer.
But only Joe, yeah.
What is the
64 is the cutoff for a baby boomer.
Not a baby boomer. Not a baby boomer.
So I'm 61, so But officially you hate everybody in the room.
Apparently.
Yeah.
How's it going for you this evening?
The strange part is I probably am like really not that at home in the millennial world, or at least I feel like a lot of millennials don't feel like we're at home.
A lot of the young performers and dancers and actors and writers from your world say they find it really difficult. They struggle because there is so much opportunity and choice. When I was at school, you know, if you wanted to be an actor in this country, there was one drama school that you could audition for, and that was it. And there were 12 places, and bugger it if you didn't get in. And now young actors can create their own work, and they've got venues like The Basement and Bats, and where they can put on these plays.
What if you're in Dunedin there?
No, I know. I know, that's tragedy.
I can't believe it.
It's an old disaster.
But it's an old model. You know, that theatre company, and that's an old model that does struggle to survive.
I think there's an underside to this, though. And this is a really small country. And actually, you know, I'm not always convinced, to be slightly reactionary, that having, you know, 24 drama schools is a good idea. There isn't enough work, there isn't enough money, there isn't enough audience for this.
But small countries like Sweden, I mean, produce the most incredible things, like in terms of machinery, like Volvo and the trucks and cars and
Motorola.
I think innovation, for sure. Yeah.
You know? What about ABBA?
Yeah.
What about ABBA?
They're the Maverick. Well, they're coming back, aren't they? They're about to release a new album. Yeah, it was in the news last week. Please. Yep, it was indeed.
I agree with you on that. Film schools,
too many film
drama
schools,
dance schools.
Yeah.
You know, and people, and what happens is people take $12,000 off you.
Yeah.
And then you do your year or your 3 years or whatever, and then you've got a student loan. And as an artist, paying back a student loan, it's oxymoron.
Hey, but what about if you go to music school, right, you go through years and years and years and years, or performance, you study performance during years and years and years, what I don't get is they never teach you actually how to put on a concert.
Mm.
What's that all about?
It's the same as actors don't get taught how to market.
100%.
Yeah, they don't. You don't go to drama school. There's no business model in there.
What's that all about? Because I think maybe that just aids universities. You just keep going back to study more, and they make more from selling more study.
It's become a commercialised education.
Letting them leave the nest and
all of education is commercialised in this country now.
Yeah,
I can definitely weigh in on that one. So in my other life, I study art history.
That's useful.
Yeah, exactly.
So you want to be a producer with an art history degree?
Honestly, producing is a bit of a side gig. If I had my way, I'd love to go and work in curatorship. That'd be brilliant.
In the visual arts?
Yeah, okay.
Well, why don't you do that?
Which is the next thing. So when I was heading out of school, I was on television, of all the things in the world, thought I was going to do acting. University threw a scholarship at me. And I was like, okay, that gives me the avenue to do what I 100% love, want to do. Mm. And I've been so fortunate with that. But I'm finishing my undergrad this semester. It's my last one. And they've just hit us with the closure of the Fine Arts Library and the closure of the Creative Industries Libraries. Mm. And
They're not closing, they're just shifting.
They're
merging.
Yeah, and it's basically been this huge thing where, like you said, it's so commercialised now, and they've just opened a new communications degree at Auckland Uni when they've got AUT across the road, whose degree is infinitely better because it's more practical. Mm. And even then, I say practical, but it's so broad that people come out of it, and like if you're in that top percentile, you're employable, and if you're anywhere below that, it's just like near impossible to get work. With art history, for example, like you're unemployable essentially until you've got a master's degree, and then with Auckland Uni, they close the libraries, you lose your absolute perfect and only real resource for research, especially if it's art history. And then all of a sudden, postgrad, what's the point? An honours degree, maybe you could get through that. Master's degree, there's just no way. And it forces you essentially to leave the country.
Mm. But the good news in all this is it'll be free for the first year from now.
But is it any better anywhere else?
Is it?
Because they're doing that everywhere, aren't they?
I think some European countries are a little bit more focused on...
Yeah, I certainly think there's a much bigger space, especially with art history particularly. Mm. I think there's a much bigger world and to go into at the end of it, but I also think that there's just a much bigger value put on it, especially, and that goes for theatre, that goes for music, I think that goes for writing.
Do you think the libraries being merged with the Central University Library is an indication of the view of how valuable the arts are?
I think it's an indication of the widespread disregard for the arts all over this country, 100%. And especially within the university, I think it just shows how little they are willing to foster it. It's the ultimate slap in the face. It's the ultimate way of saying what you study doesn't matter.
There was an article, actually, and I think it was in Granny Herald, about somebody, a student.
You mean the Auckland Property Press, otherwise known as the Herald?
A guy who was at a private school was saying that actually they should prioritise credits in NCEA for academic subjects like chemistry, physics, mathematics, statistics, over music, drama, dance, because they're harder subjects to do. And I read that and I went, I can see that, you know, I can see what he's saying, but has he ever tried to do a dance class?
I'd love to
or analyse a painting or write a review of a book or put together a film? I mean, these aren't easy tasks, are they? I mean, writing songs, it's not something that you just kind of... Well, maybe it is. Maybe it is. You just bang one out. I don't know.
Just bang them out.
Yeah.
Hey, look, you can get Microsoft Project and you can put a film together, no problem.
I mean, I think
the
problem is...
But the artistic side of it, isn't it? The creative side of it.
It's become... Well, it has always been. It's difficult for people to put a value on it. Do you know what I mean? To kind of wrap it up as a nice little... I mean, it's easy to talk about statistics or trigonometry. Or the arts is so much more nebulous in a way... Mm. That actually what's happened over time is it's sort of become too hard. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's never been easy to be an artist. You know, some people sort of bemoan the world of the arts. You've always needed a patron or to marry rich or to live in a garret. Mm. You know, you've done that for centuries. It isn't that easy to do it. But I think, you know, in a market economy, when you can't talk about it, I mean, you know, we're funded by ATEED. I think Auckland Council... And I have to be careful here because at least three of my core sponsors are being mentioned in this conversation. But University of Auckland, NZME, But you know, when ATED set up to drive tourism and to derive economic development, and Auckland Council, I think, have a very confused arts and culture strategy. In fact, dropped it out of their long term plan, and now there's a big push to try and make them put it back in.
Yes,
Len Brown talked about the world's most livable city, and we want to be a place where people want to come and work. But actually, in the end, no one knows how to plug that into an algorithm about investment and return out. And so they've sort of primarily stopped doing it. So for ATED, for us, our KPI is out-of-town visitation. That's our primary KPI.
That's it, isn't it, really?
So we have to measure our hotel nights. Are we delivering hotel nights? Mm. Now, that's something we can do, but it's not really the place where we sit as one of the country and the city's biggest cultural events. Mm. It shouldn't be our primary measure. You
know, it's like the arts festival, the film festival, the documentary festival.
Yep.
It's
a real
any
dichotomy.
Festival's on.
It's a real problem.
In music, there's a huge dichotomy. It was illustrated to me perfectly once when I played in Palmerston North at this, I can't forget the name of the venue. That the guy who ran the venue was a very unusual person because he didn't seem to be motivated by money, even though he's running a hotel and a really big bar. And these guys organised a gig for me. And I played and a whole lot of people turned up and they just sat on the dance floor. There's a lot of people there. And at the end of the night, the guy, the owner of the venue and the owner of the hotel, he's just having a beer. I'm having a beer. And he said, not big drinkers, your crowd, are they, Luke? And I said, well, how many beers did you sell in the night? There's a lot of people there. I thought I'd done really well, you know. There's a lot of people, and I played a concert, and they loved it. And I felt really proud of myself, you know. He says, not really big drinkers, your crowd, Luke. I said, well, how many beers did you sell? Do you know how many beers he sold? Two.
Oh, dear. that's not a great return on the nights.
See, that really illustrates the problem we've got. So if I write my songs, I spend years writing those songs, and then I reach people, and then a whole lot of people turn up, and they really enjoy the show. But my boss, who's
trying to make money.
Trying to make money.
Yep.
He's made nothing.
Yeah.
So I've actually
he needs to cover his costs, he
don't
make money.
They love it.
Mm.
And I'm out of a job.
Tickets.
So that's kind of, do you see what I'm saying? It kind of illustrates the problem we've got with art is that if you actually...
Well, you offer free things.
Yeah, about a third of the program's
free
actually.
Yeah.
And we're sort of holding on to that as much as we can because that's a point of engagement and it's a way of kind of... We also, ticket prices haven't really risen in the 7 years I've been there. So, but it is complicated, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you want to foster and invest in and enrichen lives with the arts. On the other hand, sometimes I think we can't keep our hospitals open in this country.
Mm.
You know what I mean? At what point do we say that just because I feel driven to be creative and to create something but no one's coming, I should be funded to do it? And I know that sounds kind of reactionary, but there's a middle ground here which says, we have to be realistic about...
Absolutely. And I hear some young creatives, often they've put projects together and they haven't done a budget to match their, the costs against the potential minimal return they'll get on seats and budgeting on, they're budgeting on 100% houses.
Yep.
And, I know.
And the other thing that people miss a lot is who's your audience?
Yeah, yeah.
So before you start making this work, know who your audience is and how do you find them?
Well, one writer said to me that they didn't actually care if anyone came and saw their work. And I thought, well, actually, I would rather give it away for free and had 400 people than charge people and no one comes. You create work for people to see it, don't you?
Well, you do,
but
Luke's
saying about going out on the street and playing music to reach people, the films, the books. Do you write a book for no one to read?
Well, some people do it because it's their creative impulse.
Yeah.
And so I guess some people care about audience more than others. I think it's fine to make your work if no one comes, as long as you're paying for it.
Mm. Yes.
I think the minute you start asking for taxpayer dollar, you need to know that
it's
you've
got
an audience.
To the taxpayer.
Well, I think that you have to show that actually, we're paying for us to make that work. So how do we...
I have a story about that, and I'm going to ask Luke to play another song, and then we're going to go to shameless promotion time because it's already after 9 o'clock. And I do appreciate that you haven't talked about sex toys again, John.
we are so waiting for that.
We are. We're looking forward to it.
I was wondering, just one question about the sex movie. Did you actually cover the people that actually... completely asexual and don't actually celibate, you know? Is that covered in the movie?
It's mentioned, strangely enough, by one of the sex workers. And I've never met this woman. She talked to the crew and I wasn't there, but she had the fantastic line, which originally was going to end the film, but we ended up with a lot of fantastic lines, so it didn't end the film, but it did end her segment, which was all about understanding that if we can't actually talk and appreciate our own sexuality, how will we ever appreciate the differences, the asexuality, the homosexuality, the transsexuality, whatever it is that we are, how we identify ourselves, we won't get that until the whole country is willing, or at least a decent number of the country is willing to just simply talk about sexuality.
And that's the focus of the film, is to get that conversation.
The film really does end up being very educational. It's entertaining, but it's educational, and it ends up with a focus saying, if we talk about this, we will simply end up in a better place. If we can find ways to have these conversations. You know, there's an example in the film where Julia mentions a friend of hers who, this came up in a conversation with one of the therapists, you know, for 20 years the couple had been kissing. And then finally one day in a therapy session, he admitted, "I don't like the way you kiss, I've never liked it."
Wow.
20 years, no conversation.
Wow.
And that was just kissing. It wasn't sex. It was kissing. That was intimacy. That was, and we don't even talk about that. And we find difficult conversations very difficult in this country.
Yes, we do. Are there any difficult conversations in the Writers' Festival this year? Is there any guests that are slightly going to be controversial?
Gotta be.
Well, I mean, obviously, we can't go past talking about the sort of Me Too movement. So we've got Robert Webb, the English comedian, Michelin Webb, Peep Show, who's written a book called How Not to Be a Boy, where he is a memoir, but it's also nice. He realised that he didn't want to be the father to his children that his father was to him.
Don't we all do that, though?
I don't know.
As a parent, I always try to improve.
Yeah.
You know, as a parent, I want to improve on what my parents did. You're shit.
What's the Me Too? What's that about?
The Me Too movement is this is a moment in time where women are saying that actually the sort of fundamental socialised way in which men see women is entirely unacceptable. And actually the way that they physically and mentally and psychologically and socially treat women is not okay. And drawing a line underneath it. So good old Robert Webb's going to get on a stage with four women and discuss how we kind of move forward from that. We've got Shashi Tharoor talking about Hinduism and the rise of fundamentalist Hinduism, which I think will be controversial. It's been highly controversial in India. So, yeah, there's a whole range of stuff we're going to talk about, and then we're going to do some musicians and have some films and have some performances.
You're having films.
We've got six films, actually. We found six films. Morris Sendak, Margaret Atwood, Amos Oz, Margaret Mahi, Hone Tufare, and one other person I can't remember. Yeah, Virago Press. Series of films about sort of people in literature. And we've also got Lawrence Arabia, Moana Mania Poto, Nadja Reid talking about their writing. And we've got an Irish Beckett actor and a small fringe piece from Australia called We May Have to Choose. And Roly Habib, the Māori kind of poet and playwright. We've got a piece with Nancy Brunning and Rawiri Paratini celebrating him. So everything. That's my blatant ad.
We haven't even got there yet.
I know. I'm going to get twice.
What's it going to be like when we get on a bit later on the show, I suppose? But, I mean, 200 and something things, you've got to get some of them out there, don't you,
yeah,
really?
I do.
You do. So what are you going to play for us this time, Luke?
This one's called The Bridge.
Yeah.
I wrote it when I was... it kind of changes every time I play it because it's kind of improvised, but the general theme is playing on the bridge with my back to Flinders Station, with the casino to the right and the flame burning, you know, in Melbourne.
Melbourne, yeah,
I don't
yeah.
know if it's still like that. But
I think it is.
It is. Yeah.
Is it? Yep. It was a really freaky night. So it became a kind of a metaphorical bridge as well as a bridge. Not big drinkers, my crowd.
Your new crowd's not so bad.
Thank you.
it all. She's a flame from the fake world. Over the river, standing on the bridge. So we'll live across the bridge. Having crossed, you don't need to look back. And where you come from is the same place you're going to. And where you came from, it ain't imbued with the fear of where you're going. And yet it's the very same place. Transit lounge, standing on a bridge. And we live our lives, need a little courage to say what's on our mind. Perfect love casts out.
And your finger work is just hypnotic, Luke. Oh, so okay. did you teach yourself that, or did you?
Well, you know how you have a plateau you've got for ages and you just no progress at all? I've been on a plateau for a long, long time, and just recently with this guitar, it's this particular guitar is kind of a lot lower. That's a baritone guitar, so kind of it's just like a new experience playing it.
Wow.
And that's where this came in. This whole style is coming to, yeah, it seems to have come very recently, last sort of even few months.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. That's really, really lovely. I love listening to the guitar, acoustic guitar. And it sounded like, at one point I thought, It sounds like there's three different guitars playing at once.
I'll give you a CD later.
So if people want to get your CDs, get your music, they can go to lukehurley.co.nz, is that correct?
Yeah, just go and have a look.
Lukehurley.co.nz, and they can download music or find out where to buy them? Or
Bandcamp.
Bandcamp?
So they're on Bandcamp and CDs, And it's a very tiny sales, it's about one a year, so if they want to call me, just give me a call. And I heard a statistic, 1.5 million. Okay, here's a question for you. This is one. This may be hearsay, but apparently this guy wrote a wrote a song for Justin Bieber, and his royalties for 1.5 million streams of that song. Now, let's have a. Shall we all have a guess how much he got paid for 1.5 million
streams?
Million streams. What would you say is a fair figure for 1.5 million people getting to?
What he got paid, or what's a fair figure?
What he got.
They're two different questions.
Forget about one cent. All I want to know now is, what do you think is a fair figure? Forget about what you've heard about how the music industry flails people alive, but just think of a figure. What is a fair figure for?
I think a musician. Did he write the song?
If 1.5 million people are listening to you, for a start, if there's in that a whole lot of psychos,
you should get at least a third.
What about the psychos in amongst those 1.5 million that might want to come and smash your head in? You know, I mean, you're going to have to protect yourself, aren't you? Yeah. How much do you think for 1.5?
I think that is the thing, what he should get paid or what he did get paid. But I think reasonable, if I think about it, and this is way off the top of my head, if you're thinking about production costs and those sorts of things, and the artist Justin Bieber singing it, the songwriter should get maybe a third. What do screenwriters get for a feature film? Do they get a proportion of sales? Is that how it works? Do you know?
Depends on their contract and what they negotiated.
It's always contract.
Some
isn't
will
it?
Get a fixed fee and walk away.
Yep.
Others will have a percentage of the gross. It depends. And that depends on their leverage. Are they
famous?
Are they a name convince people to come? Or are they just me?
Me, just churning out stuff like a copywriter. What about writers? What do they get?
Writers get a tiny little percentage. So I think, actually, I don't know the actual figure, but I think per book sale, you're probably lucky if you see $2, $2 or $3.
$2
for self publishing.
Yeah,
self publishing.
Come on.
You are. Well,
is it from, if a book's $40, that's 10%? No, whatever. 5%.
Less than that.
5%, yeah.
But then most books wouldn't be.
You won't get the. You won't get the viewership or the listenership that you'll get with music or film, though.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? The thing is,
in Luke's business and my business,
well, in some way I'm not in business.
It's available
in your
on
art.
I'd love to be in business. Please put me in a business.
In the industry Luke operates, and the industry I operate, the value of this stuff has dropped through the floor. You know, there was a time I could bring a film into New Zealand, put it in the theatres. I'd do $150,000 box office for a little German art film, take it to DVD, and there I'd make $20,000-$30,000. I got out of the film business when my little German film that did $150,000 at the box office generated 140 disc sales.
Wow.
Whoa.
Is it because it's available online?
140 discs.
No, it's because people just weren't using DVDs.
From 150,000.
The technology shift. That film wasn't available online.
Mm.
The only way you could get it is if you went to the DVD stores, but no one was buying.
They don't exist anymore, do they?
No, they don't exist.
No.
Well,
not the, do you remember, I remember number. Going out. It was a family treat.
Mm.
I'd bundle the kids in the car on Saturday afternoon, and we'd go off to the DVD store, and they'd spend about 5 hours arguing about which DVD they wanted to watch because they could never agree. And then we'd go home. Yeah. Well, I have a coffee while they did that. Go home, you know, and watch a movie with the kids, make some popcorn, and you'd watch a DVD. I mean, you know, it's not that you don't do that anymore, but it's how things are changed. Now you don't have to go out. You can order it online.
You go to Netflix, you watch the movie, you've contributed to the movie to the value of maybe a cent, which is even more than you get if you Spotify stream a song, because Spotify streaming a song is under a cent. But then that's streaming, so you don't own it.
Yeah.
There is a difference.
You can't download anything off Spotify.
Yes, you can. Absolutely.
Well, I mean, you can't. Oh, you can actually.
Yes.
Can now.
I've got a whole bunch of playlists on my phone
That's right.
that are downloaded from Spotify. So, I am a premium member.
Yeah, someone.
So that, I don't know whether the downloading is only for premiums and but whatever. So I pay, what do I pay a year?
$19 a month for $14 a month. $15 a month premium times 12. It's so, $150, $180
bucks. It's a new class in society, isn't it? You know how there's aristocrats and plutocrats and all the rest of it? Now you've got kleptocrats, eh? Like Spotify. It's just a kleptocracy.
Oh, steal it.
A cent a song. Is it a cent they pay?
Less than a cent for streaming.
But for each time it's played.
But there's a difference.
It's just an insult.
Yeah, I don't know whether they pay more when you're a premium member. But it has been so commoditized. Mm. So commoditized. Every song's worth the same. Every movie's worth the same in those environments.
And speaking of worth, if people are wanting to see your film, where do they get tickets from? Well, it's shameless, but we're running out of time, so I better get into shameless promotion time.
Tickets for Doc Edge. Can we talk about Doc Edge?
Doc Edge, yep. Fantastic festival.
If you want to go to the Doc Edge Film Festival, here is John's recommendations for watching at the Doc Edge Film Festival. Okay. Don't miss postcards.
You're speaking about yourself in the third person, John.
That's because I'm important.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Okay, Postcards from India. I think that's going to be amazing. Bar Talks by Schumann. This is a guy who has invented the best cocktails in the world, apparently. Hmm. And he goes on a journey in bars all around the world, and it's amazing. It looks amazing. Documentary on Spielberg and how he got to be Spielberg. Wow. Dealing with the Devil. You're going to want to see this, Luke. It's a music docker, and it looks really cool.
Who's that about? Just generally music?
Kleptocrats.
Possibly.
I've learned a new word.
I don't know who it's about. I watched the trailer and I went, this just looks cool.
Yeah.
And I decided I wanted to go see it. George Michael. There's a director's cut of Freedom. Golden Dawn Girls, which is about the Greeks arrested all of the leaders of the Nazi party in recent times. This is current times. Okay. And their wives and daughters went out and carried on the mission. I'm fascinated at the thinking that must be going on.
Even recently?
This was very recently. Wow. This is in the last 3 or 4 years, I gather. And then there's a short film called Listen, which is all about listening into phone calls that kids are making to counsellors.
Oh, wow.
It looks really, really interesting. And then my film, Let's Talk About Sex. And I can talk about Luke's film as well. Do you know what dates and times your film's on?
It's To Be or Not to Be.
Yes, I know that.
It's the short film.
Yes. It's on at the Roxy in Wellington on Saturday the 12th at 2:30.
Yep. Okay.
And then again on Saturday the...
Here it is. It's right there.
Sorry. Then it's on in Auckland on Saturday the 2nd of June 2018. Yep. 1:45 at the Q Theatre.
Nice.
And then my film, Let's Talk About Sex, has its world premiere in Wellington on the 16th of May, 9 o'clock. We have to play late or early so that the kids don't come to our and then it plays again Saturday the 19th at 11:45 a.m. See, there's the early one. Wednesday the 30th of May in Auckland, 9 p.m. and 31st of May at 2:45 in the afternoon.
And they just go to the Doc Edge Festival website.
They just go to docedge.co.nz and book tickets for all the movies.
All the movies. And there's a huge... It's like the Writers' Festival. There's so much to see.
There's probably 60 or 70 films.
How do you choose? That's a thing.
I just told you what to choose.
Yes, okay. Thank you, John. Richard's going to like your choices, John.
Is Richard now?
Richard is talking about himself.
With any festival, you should pick some things that really resonate for you, and then you should pick something that actually that you don't know anything about. Because what I find with festival audiences, the things that live with them and that really energise them are the things they discovered.
Yeah.
Not the things they went to sort of tick off and expect, although they are lovely, the things they discovered.
That's your silo conversation again, isn't it? So you go along to the festival and you go, well, I'll go and see, I know that author, I know that person, I know that, so I'll go and see those because then you feel comfortable.
Yeah, go to something that you just don't know anything about and just kind of surrender to it. See where it takes.
Like dope.
Yeah,
like dope.
On it to Poe.
Just before I shamelessly self-promote, I work at Q, and what we tend to recommend to patrons when they do Doc Edge is go to something you want to see and then just stay for the next film. And you just end up seeing such cool stuff. Like, I love Doc Edge. Doc Edge is my favourite festival, hands down.
I volunteer project most years. This year I'm too busy to do it, but I volunteer project. And you sit up the back and you see all these amazing.
It's just like, and you see everything as well. There's something for absolutely everyone.
Documentary is an underrated genre, as far as I'm concerned.
Anyway, Dope is on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday this week. That's Wednesday 9th till Saturday 12th. And you can get tickets from the Tapor website, or if you find us on Facebook, we're Colour Theory Productions, or Dope with a full stop after it.
As opposed to exclamation mark, question
dope.
Mark.
I can tell you for sure there's about 10,000 events that are also called
dope. Well, fun dope thing. Means great, doesn't
yeah,
it? It's like
it's
sick,
like,
dope.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I wasn't sure what that was about, because I thought...
Yeah, right, yeah. You weren't sure what it was about.
Go and see it, have that conversation. And the Writers' Festival, where do they get tickets from?
Writersfestival.co.nz, and that'll take you through to Ticketmaster, where all tickets are available.
Yeah. And so 230 different events.
207. We've done one, actually. Jeff Kinney, Diary of a Wimpy Kid. We delivered him. We presented him last week. That was our sort of taster.
Yeah.
And then we have 3 days of schools program. 7,000 students attend from across the Upper North Island. Some book awards, New Zealand Book Awards, Current Affairs Forum, gala, and then 3 days of public programming, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
So what do you do the day after it finishes?
I wave off some people from the hotel, and I lie down for a moment, and then I go back to the desk and start writing thank you notes and sending emails. Yeah, no, we do have a little bit of a moment, but we're a tiny team of four full-timers and a couple of contractors come in, then a bunch of volunteers. So you'll take a few days and then start again.
Fantastic. What an amazing show. It's been lovely chatting to you all about your... one thing I didn't actually... Sorry, you two, I haven't asked you. I know Luke talked about his where he got into with his dad and his background. He talked about your art history and your producing's part-time. What's your background, very quickly, getting into film, John?
I started by selling John Cleese training films for management and sales training in the 1970s, wearing my school uniform. Because my dad owned the business, and I went in there and just loved it. And I made about 30 or so business films in that part of my career, and then since then I've done about 10 feature films of various types.
Wow. John Cleese, they were so good, those John Cleese.
The business that made the John Cleese films.
But I didn't make them, I distributed them, yeah.
They were funny.
I didn't make the money they made.
No, God, no. And...
I got a degree in English literature. I spent about 20 years working at the Human Rights Commission, and I worked in an investment bank, once counted out gold in a vault. I helped wind up the investment division of Barclays Bank. And then I trained as a journalist, and I worked as a producer for a radio station that isn't this one, on a sort of 9 to noon current affairs program with one of this country's leading broadcasters.
That'd be Kim Hill, wouldn't
it? It was Kim Hill.
Yeah.
And then I
you
started,
gave us all the clues.
Yeah, I did. And then I started working in the art sector, so that's been the last sort of 15 years of my life, bringing all of those things together.
Yeah.
So
that's a lot of
background. Broad range of stuff. Ability to run the business, ability to kind of...
Does the investment banking pay off at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of those jobs are at taking a whole lot of information and finding sense and order and coherence in it. Mm. And that's what you do when you're an accountant. That's what you do when you produce a program. Yeah.
And I think that the arts voice is very important in business. I think for problem solving, I'm always a big advocate for people in the arts getting on business boards and stuff to have that voice when you get people who get, again, siloed and accountants and lawyers and directors going... Brr.
I agree, but I think that's a two-way street too. Actually a business brain is very important in the arts as well.
So important, to survive, if you want to survive. And you'll be finding that, won't you, as a producer? You've got to have that stuff going on.
Yeah, and especially being so young as well, you really are like just swimming in the deep end the whole time. And we've found that, I mean... I'm just lucky that I've got a bunch of friends who kind of vaguely know what they're up to. So, we were really fortunate.
None of us know what we're up to. One foot in front of the other, find your way.
Pretty much, it's all a big sham.
It is. It's true.
You'll realise that. We're all pretending at the end of the day.
Unless you start talking in the third person.
Some of us are above others in that.
Yeah, Richard will do that. Richard might adopt that as a thing to do in his show. Actually, because Richard thinks it's quite amusing. Hey, thank you. So good luck with your music, Luke.
And
if I see you in Queen Street, I can come down and talk to you.
I'm trying to work out if you sell a million on Spotify, what do you make? What do you get?
Half a cent.
Half a cent.
So half a cent.
So 500,000 cents.
Is
$50,000.
$50,000.
Yeah,
that's not bad after all.
I reckon average salary for a writer $11,000 a year.
The answer, the 1.5 million streams, $180.
$180
for 1.5 million
streams. Wow. Well, we're streaming out of here now. You can catch us streaming on. planetaudio.org.nz, or go to our website, kickarts.org.nz. We've got archives back to our shows going back 6 years. Oh, my goodness, we've been here that long. No wonder I feel tired. Maybe I should go home. And that's what I'm going to do. Thank you so much to our guests in the studio tonight. You guys are fantastic. What a great show.
Thank
you for sharing your songs and your, and your opinions and your stuff. And good luck with your events.
Thank you.
Hope they go well. Yep. I've been Richard Green. I've been your host for the last 90 minutes. I'll be back next week with Georgia. Go out there this week and kick some arts. Yeah. Love. Yeah.